Whether you're looking for answers to specific life questions or seeking to become the best version of you possible, welcome to the Mental Breakdown and Psych Reg podcast, where we offer insight, information, and strategies based upon research and years of practice as clinical psychologists. So sit back, have a listen, and get connected with our hosts, Dr. Bernie Wilkinson and Dr. Richard Marshall. Welcome back. Richard, we just finished a fantastic interview.
Yes, we did.
With Jan Poot, I think.
Van Poot.
He is from the Netherlands. And man, the work he is doing is fantastic. He has a clinic called a program called the Yes We Can Youth Clinics. Right. Yes We Can Youth Clinics, but it's yeswecanclinics.com. Right. I'll have the links in the show notes and everything, but in the interview, he shares his history, what led to him, who's not a mental health professional himself, as he pointed out.
Even though we tried to make him one.
That's right. But he just, from his own experience, has this affinity for working with youth and young adults, and is just driven to provide treatment for these guys.
He had a personal experience that we are becoming more and more familiar with. And right. One of them, he's a victim of trauma. So mm-hmm. he had the ACEs program, right. Adverse conditions, adverse circumstances. And so he had a difficult relationship with his stepfather.
Right.
Slipped into drug abuse, gambling, addiction. And he talks about his personal story mm-hmm. and how it led to him, how it led to his successful treatment,
right.
and then to build a program that provided that treatment for others. It is a fascinating story.
Yeah, it's great. And again, just to reiterate, the work that they're doing is just remarkable.
It's just...
You wish that there was a way to replicate it here, but it would be so difficult.
You know, when we talk about healthcare reform, these are the kinds of things that we should be doing.
Right.
They can do it there because of the way their healthcare system is structured. I think Canada could probably do it.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. He had his treatment in Scotland.
Right.
So these are all national healthcare programs right. where cost is less of a factor.
Right.
So you can do this. It's a three-part, and you'll hear him explain it in the podcast or during the interview. It's a three-part program.
Yeah.
And we just don't have the mechanisms to pay for some of those pieces.
Right, right. And, yeah, I think that he was talking about... it's just amazing to me. I think that the total cost is like 40,000.
Well, what did he say? It was around 50,000 euros, 40 some thousand euros,
right,
roughly.
Right.
What would that translate? I don't know.
It was, I don't know how it translates to American.
Well, it was about
dollars.
60,000 pounds.
Right.
Which
right.
would be
about $110,000-$120,000.
Right. But we spend $30,000 a month. I mean, it's far more expensive in this country than
right.
it is there.
Right.
Because you can send, if you send people to a traditional rehab center, you're talking about $20,000 to $30,000 a month.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, he talks about about the cost
right.
and about how. Not one person from the Netherlands. Mm-hmm. Not one Dutch. There's some differences with the with international clients,
right. Right.
but with those from the Netherlands, they don't pay a penny.
Right.
They don't pay a penny. So I just found it. So they have it's a 10-week residential program that
right.
costs 64,000 euros, 55,000 pounds, and then they have a 16,000 euro. A 4-week residential program,
right?
And not one penny comes from the family,
right? The families don't have to pay for it,
and so that includes the time that the youth or young adult spends at the facility, as well as family therapy.
That's right. What I like about it is you have this very intensive, but gradual, residential program,
right?
Inpatient, and then you have a transition program,
right?
And then you have family therapy,
right?
So that they insist that the family make changes
right.
before the kids go back.
Right. Now,
so important.
What some of you listeners will really like, it was his discussion about gaming. The second most common addiction that the youth come in with is an addiction to gaming.
The first is our little friend,
marijuana,
Mary Jane.
Mm-hmm.
And he said it used to be marijuana, alcohol, cocaine, and gaming. Now it's marijuana, gaming, and then the others fall in after that. But he told some hair-raising stories about some kids who were addicted to gaming.
Yeah. So definitely,
check out this one.
Listen. Mm-hmm. He's great to talk to. He's just doing some amazing work. So,
very good work.
So we definitely encourage you to check his work out. Mm-hmm. The link in the show notes will go to his clinic site, but also to his social media site. Right. So if you want to follow his work, so all right.
Yeah, take a look at that one.
Yeah, absolutely. So, all right, enjoy the interview.
Good morning,
Jan.
It's great to finally talk with you. I know that we've kind of had some hit and misses and everything, but it's great to talk with you.
And the same as well. Yesterday morning we tried it, but there was somewhere a disconnection. But today everything is good. And I'm sitting here looking outside a window where it's raining enormously. So I hope the weather is better at your place.
It is right now, but about, probably close to when we arrive at the same time that you're at right now. So early afternoon, it'll start pouring here as well. So
every day in the afternoon.
Really?
The mornings are fine, but every afternoon we have a torrential downpour.
Right.
And then it dries up and it's like a jungle.
But, Where are you at the moment? Is it Florida? Is that correct?
Yes. Central Florida.
We're right in between, halfway in between Tampa and Orlando.
Okay.
So,
great. I am in a small town called Hilvarenbeek, and it's about 1 hour under Amsterdam.
Oh, wow!
In the Netherlands, of course.
Yes. Well, it's great to talk to you. We've heard a little bit about you and all from Dennis. At PsychReg, and I know that you did an interview with him not too long ago.
Yes, in London, yes.
Yeah, so that's, we're really happy to have the chance to talk with you because, man, you look like or seem like you're doing a whole lot of work over there with your clinics.
Yes, we are here for 6 years now, and we've grown enormously, not because we wanted it, but just because the waiting lists for these children, these teenagers and young adults with these type of problems, the addictions and mental disorders and mental problems. In the Netherlands, and I assume it's the same all over the world, this is something that we are experiencing right now. It is so big and it's growing so strong that even though in the small country, the Netherlands, we grow in 6 years' time from a 30-bed residential setting to a 120-bed residential setting.
Wow.
And even today, we still have waiting list going up to 2 months. We're pretty busy.
Hey, Jan, one of the things that we always talk about here is how this is financed. Do you have a national healthcare system?
Yes, we have. Yeah.
Do they pay for that, or do the patient, residents pay for it? Do the fellows pay for it?
Yeah, no. Since the middle of 2011, the Yes We Can Youth Clinics has got from the government the approval to treat the children the way we do. And everything is for the Dutch teenagers and young adults is being paid for by the insurance companies. That is when they are over 18. And all the teenagers we treat under 18 are being paid for by the councils. So to put it in other words, there's no family in the Netherlands who needs to pay for this type of treatment. It is different for the international clients we treat. We are trying all over the world to get the same agreements, to get the same contracts with insurance companies. But that takes a while. That's something we know. Yeah.
Well, you know, it's certainly a significant issue here in the States. I don't know how much publicity any of that gets around the world, but you know, we've had lots of debates and issues and
challenges with our own healthcare system. So it's wonderful that you're able to have, you know, that kind of support for these adolescents and even young adults, it sounds, who are struggling with some of these issues, where they don't have to worry about the financial obligations, because that can be a pretty extensive treatment.
Yeah, absolutely, yeah. But the good thing that we see now, and this is also the cooperation we have with insurance companies and government, when we don't treat these children, what we see is that they finally end up in closed setting, in youth prisons, or even worse, staying for a long time in hospitals. Mm-hmm. And if you compare that amount of money that is being spent for, let's say, 1 year in a close, which we call in the Netherlands a closed setting, that will cost around between 100,000 and 150,000 euros for 1 year. If you compare that to the treatment of 20 weeks, which we provide, and which is around 40,000 euros, and with the effect we have at this moment for almost 70% of the teenage and young adults who finish our program, where they can leave the specialized healthcare, if you compare those two, then the math is pretty easy. And you can see that the treatment we provide is not only helping the teenage and young adults getting back into normal life, but it's also, in the end, it saves a lot of money for the government and insurance companies.
Mm-hmm. Wow, that's and it's great that you guys, even, you know, that you're using that. I don't want to be too simplistic with it or anything like that, but it's great that you're looking at this, that kind of common sense decision making, because it's really challenging here in the States to, when we're trying to make those same kind of arguments, because the same kind of statistics exist here, where, you know, those youth who are struggling with mental health and substance abuse issues, mm-hmm. you know, they're on a fast track to the juvenile justice system or the youth prison system, and we're not really doing a whole lot systematically to deal with that.
And it's something we see not only in you're talking about the United States, but it's also things we see encounters around us, so in Europe as well. Gladly, we also see. I don't know if you have heard about it, but if you look at Iceland, the small country Iceland, with I believe a population of 350,000 people, at this moment, for the teenagers under 16, because they spent the last 15 years, they spent so much money and energy in preventing instead of, you know, treating when the symptoms are already there. And what you see now, that there, I believe there's only about 3% under 16 in Iceland who smoked marijuana or drank alcohol.
Wow.
And there you can see the effect of investing 15 years for prevention and what kind of effect it does. And I believe at this moment, too many countries are still spending all the money to the people who need it the most. And of course that needs to be done, because otherwise the people will die. But if you don't spend as well, you know, invest in the prevention, and this will go on and on and on for decades, and the system is not going to change. So I strongly believe in specifically, you know, spend energy in prevention.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
Well, Jan, I suppose everybody asks you, they begin by asking you the same questions. What motivated you to start the program?
Yes.
So let's begin with that one.
Kind of go back.
Let's go backwards now.
Okay. I'll try to keep it as short as possible. I need to give you a little bit about my own life. In the age of 12, I was living at home at my mom, and that was a pretty unhealthy situation and place for me to live in. I had a stepfather who was living there as well, alcoholic, very aggressive, and I won't get into details too much, but it was two to 3 years seriously hell for me and the rest of the family who was living there. When I was beginning of 13, for me it felt so unsafe, and it was so unsafe inside of my house that I decided to go out of the house. I spent most of the day on the streets, a little, some hours at school, but this also changed very quickly when I found my solution of coping with the emotions and the feelings I tried to dealt with every day. The anger, the fear, the insecurities, the pain, the aggression that was inside of my head was so big that I found two things. And one was I found marijuana, so I didn't have to feel anymore. And the other thing, I found gambling, so I didn't have to think. And this combination was, for me, was my solution with the problems I coped with. This went on and on for many years until those two things didn't work anymore for me. And I found at the age of 18, I found cocaine and alcohol. And this was the perfect mix for me, again, where I thought that that was the solutions to just cope with life. At the age of 19, it was so bad that nobody wanted me anymore. And on the other hand, I didn't want to live myself anymore. So suicide thoughts were getting more and more and more. There were more times where I thought of leaving and dying instead of living. So my first residential treatment started from the age of end of 18. This lasted until the age of 27. So I spent 9 years in and out of treatment centers. And what my experience of that was that all the 30, 40 psychologists, psychiatrists, care workers who tried to help me had a huge, huge heart. But there was one thing missing all the time. And I cannot else say it like this, and that was, they did not give me a real good reason to change. For me, my solution of drinking, using, and staying in misery was still more, felt safer than going into the path they wanted to get me into. And for me now, I couldn't understand why that it wasn't working at that time, but for me now, I can understand it and explain it that there, I did not have the connection. I did not have the connection with the specialist. I spent in a treatment center, residential treatment centers, where there was drug abuse, where women felt sexually abused, where bullying was there all the time, where the fear and aggression was the way people were living inside those treatment centers. And also I saw the staff members coping with so much troubles that the only way they could deal with this was I'm not sure the right word in English, but just to try to keep everybody calm. And by doing that was that at the moment somebody looked aggressive or started saying from, hey, I don't agree with this, bam, they would get that person, separate him. So, you know, so the real problems never came up the surface. After when I was 27, this is now 13 years ago, and then I went to a treatment center in the UK, in Scotland to be precisely. And there for the first time, I got introduced to a treatment where a perfect balance of psychiatrists, psychologists, combined with experienced workers, so people who've been there themselves, the counselors, and those counselors, who've been addicts themselves, who've been through hell themselves, they gave me that reason to change. They showed me that, one, I'm okay. I'm absolutely a good person. Two, they overwhelmed me with warmth and love. But three, I also accepted them when they started confronting me because my behavior had to change. But I accepted it from them, but not anymore from the psychologist. Because for me, the psychologists were, at that moment, were the ones who did not understand me because they did not have my life. And what they did in the first 3 weeks, they overwhelmed me with these counselors. And on the right moment, when I said, okay, I am now ready, just tell me what to do because my way isn't working anymore. And that was the moment where the psychologists and psychiatrists came in. And then the way they were working multidisciplinary was just brilliant. I stayed there for 6 months. And since that day, November 16, 2004, I never had to use or drink again. I went back to the Netherlands after 6 months, I went to the fellowship. I went in because of my biggest problems were my addiction, so I went to the fellowship of AA, CA, and NA, which is also a big fellowship in the Netherlands. I also got for over a year a great aftercare program. And after a year, I realized that maybe I can start working with teenagers and young adults, not in the healthcare system. I was so happy that after 15 years, I was out of that system, so I never wanted to be there anymore. But just by providing teenagers and young adults something which I never had, and that was just having fun, you know, having fun. And being able to be a normal teenager. I have no idea how it is to be a normal 14-year-old to 16-year-old. And my thoughts were, okay, maybe I can help to give those kids just 1 week of fun. So I started a company with providing survival camps, outdoor camps, work holidays with schools, where we would get every week, sometimes 20, sometimes 100, and this grown up till almost 500 teenagers and young adults a week, where we would just provide 1 week of fun. It went on and on, and the last 3 years of that company, more and more institutions, youth care clinics, addiction clinics, rehabs, came also to this company because they heard, hey, you are doing something which is so much fun for those teenagers and young adults, so please do that as well for our clients and our patients. And this for me was an introduction into the youth care mental health, in the youth mental health care. But it was also for me one big recognition because every week there were all small young Willems coming in where I had so much recognition. I could see the way they were manipulating, I could see the way they were lying, I could see the way the group dynamics were working inside the groups. So that was much fun. But I also heard the stories about the things I discovered myself. So still then, there were children who felt, who were with a lot of fear inside those institutions. Women telling that they were sexually being bullied, sexually being abused inside those clinics. That still, and I'm talking about 6 years ago now, that still drug using was there in rehab centers in the Netherlands. And I couldn't understand, you know, that for me 20 years later, not really much has changed into the system. And by talking with the psychologists and the mental health care workers, they also said to me, "From yes, it's true, gladly we can help about 60-70% of those children, but there is a group which we just cannot get our hands on." And this was the group where I finally decided that, okay, then probably this has, you know, this is a sign or given a name. But 7 years ago, I decided that I would sell that sports company. And with a little bit of money I had, I could start with Yes We Can clinics. Firstly, we did three pilots, three times 10 clients, which was a success. And not that they changed completely, but we could see that the treatment we provided, the warm and loving environment, the extreme safety we wanted to have to give those children, but also confront them at the right time. This was the right, these were the right ingredients to motivate those children by getting into recovery, by getting into treatment. And then in the middle of 2011, the government said to us, "Okay, we want you to move on. We want to pay for the treatment you are giving. Make sure your team is correct with the right people, the right psychiatrists, the right clinical psychologists, with the right evidence-based treatments. But please keep on doing what you're doing, because you're doing something where too many treatment centers in the Netherlands are having so much problems with." So that was our goal. And in the last 6 years, just to end the story, we started with a staff of 20 people. Today we are with a staff of 175, extremely loyal and hardworking psychologists, psychiatrists, coaches, and medical nurses. We started with the 20 to 25 beds, and today we have 140 beds, including the 20 beds for the international clients. And our success rate with the effectiveness, which we every month we let that check with an independent institutions here in the Netherlands, which is something we have to do by law. And everything which we can see at this moment is that all the kids, all the teenagers who end their residential treatment and also the 10-week aftercare, including the families, because we also provide an extremely well family program for them, we can see that after those 20 weeks, we can see that 70% of those teenagers can finally, after years and years of being in a specialized mental health care, they can leave this mental health care system. And that is a number which we are, of course, very grateful for.
Wow.
So as short as possible. I'm sorry for talking a lot.
No, that's fantastic. Wow.
Jan, you are all of your fellows, do they have two diagnoses, addiction and some sort of mental illness?
I would say, I don't have the exact numbers, but I would say from what we heard from psychologists, that we have almost 80% of the children who come in, they have absolutely a double diagnosis.
Dual diagnosis, right, okay.
Yeah, I really like, there was something that you mentioned a couple of times, one in your personal story, but then two, you know, as part of your treatment model, you were emphasizing the importance of you know, confronting them at the right time.
Right.
I think that is a huge issue because so many times, you know, therapists or psychologists or psychiatrists even will attempt to confront someone way too early and the person is not ready. Have you been lucky with your professionals and your staff to find people who understand that and can see that? Or is that something that you guys do training for when it comes to the people who provide treatment for your residents?
I think that is the beauty of working with a multidisciplinary team, where also the counselors, so the experts by experience colleagues, is that the way you use as well, expert by experience counselors?
No, not as often. We do have counselors who, you know, have gone through some of these life experiences and decided to go into the field, but you know, we certainly don't have that as a basis for providers.
Okay, yeah, but I believe that makes it that the psychologists and the psychiatrists, they can get, you know, the information from first hand. You know, when we have so many psychologists who go to these people who've been there themselves and explain what they are going through with their client, and then say, I'm stuck, you know, I have this kid for 2 weeks, I can't get a connection, he doesn't trust me, I can't get through to him. And then, you know, because the people who are also in the primary progress by the experts of experience counselors, they can help the psychologist by giving them by first hand, you know, the way they've been through it. Sometimes they go in together. So sometimes the psychologist asks, hey, please come with me in the coming two or three one-on-one sessions. So maybe you can get that trust. Maybe you can get through that first wall, you know, which we all know of, specifically with teenagers. And that is our experience. So we see that the teenagers and young adults quicker trust somebody who's been there themselves. Mm-hmm. So that is why specifically in the first week we start with them, and when the trust is there, when they feel safe, when they are, which we called in their action one, when they say, okay, my ways are not working anymore, please tell me what to do, that is the moment, you know, where the real treatment can start, where the CBT can start, where the motivational treatment can start, or maybe EMDR or trauma therapy. But we don't start before we are absolutely sure that the teenager and young adult is ready for the treatment.
Jan, I have a question about ready for treatment. In our country, we have AA and NA, but the teenagers typically say, I can't identify with the adults because they have lost families, they've lost their homes, they've lost their jobs. The teenagers haven't lost anything. And they always tell us the same thing. They don't want to quit because there's no reason to. When you say ready to say, my way isn't working, what actually is happening? What is occurring in these teenagers that they're willing to give it up, even though they haven't lost everything.
Yeah. Well, what we experience is that we also treat 14 or 15 year old addicts. In those first 8 weeks, when we start, when this is a program, you know, where the rest of your life you need to be abstinent from all alcohol, drugs, gaming, etc. You just have to look in their eyes, you know, it's like, okay, from now on my life is hell, you know, that's the way they think, and we understand that as well. So we don't go too quickly to that stage where we advise them, you know, to get to the rest of their life and to live for the rest of their life and abstinent life. What we do is that we try to get them into the treatment which we provide, not what the AA or CA or NA provides or advises, but what we provide. And what we provide is just get into treatment and start working, you know, on all the things you've been through in your life. Make sure, you know, that everything that's done to you or everything you have done to other people, you know, that we can really, after that residential program, we can say, okay, that is then, and now let's look at the rest of your life. We have exactly the same thing of teenagers who, when they leave at our place and we advise them to go into the fellowship, and they would get back to our aftercare program, and they would say the same. At least I'm the only guy from 16, and the rest is over 30 or 40.
Right.
And it's only people who are lying under the bridge, whereby, you know, all the stories have been through. What happened in the last 6 years is that a group of Yes We Can fellows was so sick of getting into those rooms where they did not get the right recognition. So they started their own groups. So we have a lot of teenager groups, youth groups in Amsterdam, in the south of the Netherlands, in the east of the Netherlands, in the north of the Netherlands, where they can go to themselves. But there's also a group which, because in the Netherlands the fellowships know about Yes We Can, and they know every week it is possible that maybe new fellow, where they welcome them so much, so and they understand that when a 16 or 17 year old comes into that fellowship, they understand what they're going through. So it is difficult, but it's absolutely possible to get teenagers into the fellowship and also stay sober for a long period.
Wow. Yeah, I mean, that's huge. And you know, again, it's something that we agree, we've talked about a lot of times here, both on our podcast, but also, you know, outside of the podcast, the importance of that, you know, those kind of teen groups where, you know, teens are supporting teens and teens are, you know, able to express what their experiences are, because as you said, you know, a lot of times teenagers will disregard some of the things that we as adults suggest or recommend or encourage, just because, you know, we're old and what do we know? So, you know, they are able to learn so much from each other.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Yes. Yeah.
So, you go ahead.
Well, you just sort of very casually mentioned we take them off all. You have a detox program first, where you take them off everything, and you said marijuana, alcohol, and very gently you said gaming. I want to know more about that.
Well, gaming is actually at this moment the second addiction where the teenage young adults come in. So when we started, it was marijuana first, alcohol second, cocaine and speed third, and then gaming. In 6 years' time, gaming is the second addiction they come into. 25% of all the men and boys who come in to our treatment, they are coming in with a gaming addiction. A lot of times combined with signs of autism, and also with ODD, so again, you know, it's not only the gaming which is a problem, but also psychiatric problems which are behind it. But gaming is huge. The gaming problem is seriously huge. It's getting more and more extreme. Kids who've been gaming, when they come into our place, been gaming for the last 3 years, non-stop 18 hours a day, where it went so far, you know, that even not showering for weeks, urinating in the room. So you probably know all the stories. But it's something we see every week, kids coming in to our clinic. Yeah, so it's a big, big problem.
Mm-hmm. And with those youth and young adults are, well, I guess what I'm wondering is, how do they get to your clinic? Is it recommended by other professionals? Is it that their parents, you know, set up an intervention? Is it that they have arrived at some point where they seek it out or they ask for it? Or, you know, because I can imagine, you know, teens that are at that point, especially with gaming, but also with other substances, that they're not necessarily going to seek out treatment themselves. So how do they get to your clinic?
Yeah. I believe 90% it is the parents. They see that, you know, that their way isn't working anymore. They have no idea how to cope with a kid anymore, how to communicate. There's no connection. I believe the stories we hear, you know, it's from the morning till the evening. It's only fighting. Or they don't have a clue where the kid is. You know, I mean, sometimes they spend weeks and weeks on the streets and they have absolutely no idea where they are. So it's the parents. It starts with the parents. We never had one teenager who came in to our head office where the intake is who said, "Oh, I'm so happy, please." You know? We never had that. they did get in saying, "I'm dying," you know, but they never came in so happy to start treating. So what happens is that when the parents call us or they get in contact with us, we help them how to motivate their kids just to get into the first talk, to get into the first intake, not to get into treatment. Treatment is later. You know, first let's just get together. And that is difficult, you know, specifically for parents, because these teenagers has been through years and years already for ambulance care, with hours of talk per week with a psychologist or psychiatrist, and most of the times these teens don't believe in the healthcare anymore, the mental health care anymore. So when needed, again, also with our team in our head office where the intake is, and that is separate from where the residential clinic is, we also again have a team of case managers who understand this, who also have been there themselves. And those are the ones when needed, where they will call the teenager, young adult, and they will show them that it's a little bit different what we do compared to what they've been through. And they were seeing 90% of the times that then the kids, the team, the youth is ready to say, okay, then I will come for the first talk. Sometimes, like this, you know, when you see dad getting out of the car, dragging in the teenage and younger girls, but that's okay.
So you don't have many volunteers.
from the teenagers.
No teenage volunteers, right?
Yeah.
Hey, I have a kind of a technical question. In the interview, the work that I've read, you talk about that your abuse led to addiction. From abuse, you went to addiction. What's the difference?
From myself, you mean? Or,
yeah, but
or...
how do you differentiate abuse from addiction?
Yeah, okay. I believe that if I look at my own life,
yes,
from the moment where I woke up thinking about using or gambling or smoking marijuana or you know, any other thing that you know I needed just to get rid of the normal life. So where I woke up and my first thoughts were there, and when I went to bed, my last thoughts were there. Then it's pretty easy. No, then okay. It's not abuse anymore. Then it's absolute addiction.
Okay.
From the moment where you stop saying what you promised, when you stop going to parties, when you start lying to all the people you love, when you start stealing money just to provide your addiction, then he abuses God and it's an addiction. I think that's pretty easy to see, you know, where it's abuse and when it's and it's when it starts an addiction. It's more difficult because the addict will not say, you know, and specifically not in the beginning, that he's doing those things. So it's up to the healthcare specialist or the parents to decide with the things you hear from the person you talk with, if it's still abuse or it is an addiction. And that's sometimes difficult. It's very difficult because nobody wants to hear, specifically not me, when I heard for the first time at 17, a psychologist said to me, I think you're an addict. You know, bomb. I said, no way, you know, I'm not like that at all. But I also needed someone to say it for the first time. And that was then that person. And even though I wasn't ready to admit it, you know, things were going on, you know, the seeds were planted in my head. And at the end of 18, I was the one who said, yes, I am an addict.
Wow. It sounds like, you know, just again, kind of thinking about, as you were just describing, but also thinking about how you've described the model that you guys use at Yes We Can Clinics, it's the first and most important thing is developing a relationship. You know, it sounds like you guys really work from that model and really kind of focus on the model that, you know, treatment begins with trust, and trust comes from relationships. You guys have a lot of focus on building that initial relationship so that you can, you know, when a person is addicted in the way that you were just describing, you know, what's going to pull a person from that or help them come from that is knowing that somebody cares and somebody is there to support and again, that relationship. We talk about that very often because we think that's true. Not just in this field, but, you know, in education, right. It's true in so many other areas of life that you have to have those important relationships.
Yeah, absolutely. And I even think that, you know, that we as adults, we need to show them, you know, we need to give them the right example. You know, we need to show these teenagers and young adults the right example. And that's something I believe all over the world where we are losing that. Now, we are so busy with our own lives. We are so busy with our own issues, with our own problems. We are so busy with our phones, with our iPads, you know, etc. That I believe we slowly are stopping to really educate or let teenagers grow the way which is normal. Mm-hmm. I think it's not normal at this moment why so many teenagers, for example, are doing sexting, you know. It's normal for them. For them, at this moment, it's normal to take a picture of their naked bum, you know, and post it on Instagram or Facebook or whatever. And they're not even thinking about the consequences. But I truly believe because we as adults stopped somewhere by giving them the rights and wants. Or we're not doing that consequently. That's my personal beliefs, and also the experience we have with the thousands of parents we talk to as well. They all say one thing: we stopped being a good parent. We stopped showing our kids what is right and what is wrong.
Absolutely. I mean, recognizing where they come from, you know, the home that they come from, the culture, the family that they come from is so important. Mm-hmm. So,
absolutely.
Jan, I'm going to go over one more thing. You probably already said it, but I want to make sure I understand it. You said that in your own experience as an addict and also as a therapist, that you needed to start a new program. What was missing in the existing programs? What was missing, and what is your program providing?
Yes, I understand. Okay. First of all, I just have to tell you, I'm not a therapist. I want to say that out.
We just made you one.
Honorary.
You're a therapist, whether you want to be or not.
I have an idea of what is good for children and how to provide a warm and loving and safe environment. But I'm not doing one-on-one sessions.
Mm-hmm.
that's fair. Okay, so what I from my own experience and also from the experience I saw talking with hundreds of children before we started working with Yes We Can, before I started Yes We Can Clinics, we saw that the teenagers were saying every time that we don't feel safe. They're not giving us a reason to change. They are. It feels like we are the prisoner, and the staff members are the guards.
Right.
And also what I heard a lot, and I know psychologists and psychiatrists hate it when I say it, but it's the truth. They say we have constantly the feeling that the people are sitting in front of us are just saying the things they learned from the books instead of the experience they've been to themselves. And even though I don't agree with that completely, I can relate to them, because you get to that stage where you have the feeling that everybody's only saying you have to do this, or advise you that, blah, blah, blah. And you get to that stage where you don't want to hear that anymore. So the difference between most of the teenage and young adults treatment centers and Yes We Can Youth Clinics is absolutely the combination of working multidisciplinary with three teams. One, the specialists, psychologists and psychiatrists. Two, the experts by experience counselors, the people who've been there. And three, the 24/7 the people who are 24/7 there, which we call the youth coaches.
Okay.
And the third one, some call it in clinics caretakers, but the third one is we have, on a group of 120 clients, we have 35 of those youth coaches in the clinic, and those are like the big brothers and sisters.
Mm-hmm.
Those are the ones who wake the children, those are the ones who are there at the free time, those are the ones who provide the sports activities, those are the ones who in the evening as well provide psychoeducation. But also, those are the ones who are there in the beginning when the kid starts crying, or when the kid starts feel scared, or when he's missing his mom or dad. And so we provide an environment where that warm and loving feeling which they ever had with their family, that's something where the youth coaches are there for these clients. So in all fronts, you know, we have, in all stages where the clients are in, we have people who are there at the right time. For example, we get again a kid in. He's been sexually being abused for many years. He comes in with the cocaine habit. He's got a lot of aggression, a lot of anger inside of him. So he comes in, and we know then at that moment that in the first week, you know, we have to be careful not to push on the. Push too quickly on the buttons, because then, bam, you know that, you know, it starts exploding. So what we do, we make sure that he lands in slowly. And we make sure that one of the youth coaches, who has a little bit similar life maybe like him, or maybe has the same hobbies like, I don't know, sporting, fitnessing, kitesurfing or whatever. So they connect to each other.
Mm-hmm.
And then when it's this kid with so many troubles, when he starts feeling safe, then slowly we let the psychologist get in. And we try to look if, hey, is it already okay if we start talking slowly about the sexual abuse or the other traumas? And when we see when we're going too fast, bam, the psychologist backs off again and gives more time at that moment for the youth coach or maybe a counselor to first again start working with the connection and the trust and the warm love. And this is something which works perfectly what we experience. We have all the teenagers 10 weeks. Sometimes we can start the treatment within a week because within a week they feel safe. Sometimes we can start the treatment in week 8. So we only have 2 weeks of treatment. But then the first 8 weeks has been just as important as the last 2 weeks with the real treatment. So that is something which I strongly believe which we separate us from other youth care institutions.
That's fantastic. That's great stuff.
I wish we could do that here.
And I really like how you define the roles of everyone. You know, it's not, you know, you don't refer to them as patients. You refer to them as fellows, the youth and the young adults. And you refer to, you know, you talk about professionals from experience. You're not, you know, necessarily, you talk about them as being counselors, but, you know, they're professionals through experience. And that... oftentimes that kind of terminology makes such a huge difference, because it just it creates a little bit more of a connection between everyone. It's not the patient and the therapist. It's the fellow and the experienced one. I think that is really a great touch that you guys that you guys use.
Thank you. And also, I think one thing I haven't mentioned, but which is maybe just as important, is to make sure, you know, that 7 days a week, they wake up at 6:45 in the morning. They go to bed at 10:30 at night, and within all those hours, there's only 4 times 30 minutes of free time, and the rest is group sessions, one-on-one session, psychoeducation, sport activities, psychiatric consults. And so there's no way, you know, where they can get back, you know, in their old thoughts, mm-hmm. or start
keep them busy.
Okay, when you give those teenagers too much free time,
mm-hmm.
you know, they tear the place apart.
Exactly.
We know.
So I also believe in that. I see a lot of treatment centers who give too much spare time, give too much pauses between the treatments or between the activities, and those are the moments where your behavior comes back again. And if you don't look out, then maybe one when it starts, it always starts with one. You know, when one is getting into a bad space, then you know it's the second one comes, and he affects him or her, and then the third one, and it can happen that within 1 or 2 days, you know, when it starts with one person who is negative, then boom, within 48 hours you maybe have 20 people. And it is our job to make sure that, you know, the first one who is negative, that he or she gets an attention which he needs, so the other ones are not affected with that negativity. But it takes a lot of people. So with the 120 teenagers and young adults we have, with 120 fellows, we have 130 staff members. Exactly.
Wow.
So, yeah.
Good ratio.
It is, and we've kept you for a while now, but I do have one last question. If you have a few more minutes.
Sure.
Okay. You mentioned earlier, and we just kind of moved past it, really focusing on some of the other work, but. You mentioned some of the work that you do with families. You know, certainly it's so important that we think about, as we were talking about earlier, that we think about where the kids come from, where these the youth and young adults come from. And so healing from the origin is so important as well. What kind of work do you guys do with the families?
Yes, a lot. First of all, we specifically mention to the parents, if they want their children, their teenager, their kid to be treated, they have to go and treatment themselves. And we do that as well. We have a big team of family counselors, systemic therapists, where for the Dutch clients, for Dutch fellows, those parents will come in week 2, week 4, week 5, week 7, and in week 9. They will have 3 hours, so one half a day, of family therapy. Without their kid, only with themselves. And what we do that in group therapy. So we have, let's say, 6 moms and dads all together in one group. And the focus there is not on their kid, no, the focus is on their behavior. And they love that, no, they don't.
It's so important though, wow.
It's extremely important. They have to see what their part in this situation is.
Yeah.
Otherwise, it's absolutely you can give a teenager a year treatment, mm-hmm. you know, but if you don't treat the parents as well, right. It's absolutely a waste of time and a waste of money.
Yeah.
We strongly believe in that. So that's also why we decided from the beginning on that when mom and dad is coming into our clinic and they are saying, "Here's our kid, please fix him. We pick him up in 20 weeks." Mm-hmm. That's the moment we say, "No, we're not going to do that. Here is your kid again." Even though he needs the treatments so hard at this moment, it's not going to work. If you want the kid to be treated, you have to be treated as well.
Wow.
That's great. That's fantastic.
Yeah, and it's absolutely needed. So I advise seriously all the people who are working with these teenage and young adults, never forget the parents. It's so important.
Right. Yeah, I think that returning to a home that is just as ill as it was when the child left, only contributes to recidivism and the return to those bad behaviors or the bad habits that they had before they even had treatment. So it makes complete sense. So, well, tell our listeners how they can get more information about what your work is, and you know, Yes We Can clinics, and if they want to follow you on any social media or anything like that, how can they best follow you?
Yeah, well, we the company name is Yes We Can Youth Clinics. The website we have for all the international for all the international families, but also for all the people who are interested, is yeswecanclinics.com. There, of course, we have all the information we have. I know we are on Twitter. I know we are on Facebook. And you can find it by just searching for Yes We Can Youth Clinics. We are, at this moment, specifically in Europe, at a lot of congresses. More and more gladly, you know, we can also give presentations to and multiple groups at big congresses, etc. But we try to, specifically on the social media side, so on Facebook and on Twitter, etc., we try to give all the new updates as much as possible.
Well, great. Well, I'll include links to all of that in the show notes of the podcast and the videos and everything, so that folks can find it and follow your work. So, man, it's been. Did you have any other
been
questions?
A pleasure. No.
It's been fantastic talking with you, and we'd love to talk to you more. If there's anything that you have coming up or anything else that's going on, you know, please don't hesitate to let us know, and we'll get in touch, and we'll have another talk and get the information out.
Okay, great. Thank you very much for having me, and it's been a real pleasure, and it's actually a lot of fun doing this.
Good. We enjoyed it. Thank you.
Once we got the technical stuff worked out, it was great.
Yes, our thanks to Stefan.
Yes,
I will give it to him.
Okay.
All right. Thanks a lot. Have a lovely day, and I hope to see you soon.
Good.
All right, thanks.
Thank you.
You too. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. Thank you. Bye.
Bye.